Somali-born American author and activist Ayaan Hirsi Ali is one of the world's best-known and most strident critics of Islam. Born in East Africa, where she suffered genital mutilation, she sought political asylum in the Netherlands before entering parliament in that country. An early book, Infidel, she told of turning her back on the religion of her childhood and embracing a campaign for the rights of Muslim women. Her campaigning has made her the target of death threats from outraged radical Islamists and from liberal Westerners who see her condemnation of elements of Islam as xenophobia. As The Guardian put it in a review of her latest book, Heretic, Why Islam Needs a Reformation Now, the liberal left has variously accused her of being a self-hating Islamophobe and a traumatised apologist for Western imperialism. Well, the book is a call for moderate Muslims and Western liberals to join with her and others to push for a Muslim reformation where imams and clerics forbid jihad and reconcile their religious doctrine with the modern values of gender equality. Ayaan Hirsi Ali joins us on the line now from New York. Welcome to RN Breakfast.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to RN Breakfast. Thank you for being my guest.
Thank you for having me on.
You describe in the book three types of Muslims. You talk about Medina Muslims, Mecca Muslims, and a final group who you say understand the need for reform. Take me through that landscape as you see it.
Medina Muslims are those who, in the name of Islamic scripture, the Quran, and the example of the Prophet Muhammad, are committing crimes against humanity right now. Killing people, selling women into slavery, persecuting Christians and other religious minorities. We've seen very vivid and brutal pictures of, you know, taking a man, putting him in a cage and setting him on fire. We've seen the beheadings. We've seen Coptic Christians and Ethiopian Christians lined up on a beach in Libya and being beheaded. The men who are doing that, they are what I call Medina Muslims. Mm. The Mecca Muslims, I think, are the largest number of Muslims in the world. They are going about their business, they worship, and they have no intention of causing other people harm inspired by their religion. And then there is a small group of people, which I think is growing ever larger. I call them the reformers, the heretics, those individuals who are asking questions. And the reformers and the Medina Muslims are fighting for the hearts and minds of the vast majority of Muslims who are the Mecca Muslims. Mm. And I clearly and explicitly side with the reformers.
And so what you're describing in this book at the outset is a fight for the centre. When you talk about Mecca Muslims, you're talking about moderate Muslims everywhere, this fight for the hearts and minds of the centre.
I think the term moderate is pretty useless. Because what does moderate mean? What does extreme mean? People get really offended if they're Muslim and you start giving them the title moderate. I think it's much more accurate to place them really in which part of Muhammad's example do they want to follow. And these distinctions are much more useful than what we have in place at moderate fundamentalist and so on.
And so you're arguing that the Mecca Muslims need to choose. They cannot sit in a comfortable centre. They need to choose.
They need to choose, and they're being forced to choose by the Medina Muslims. I'll give you an example. If you are the mother or the father of a child who sneaks out to join the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, you're now filled with grief, and you're asking yourself, what have I done wrong? Where did I go wrong? Mm. And if you get to that place where you're asking yourself, where did I go wrong? I would say, if there's anything that parents have contributed to the choice that an individual makes, 15-year-old is still a child, but pretty much capable of doing things on their own. I would say what parents have failed to do is to teach the child critical thinking, so that when the person comes who's trying to brainwash them, the child should be capable of saying, wait a second, do I have to follow in absolutely everything that Muhammad has dictated, or can I ask questions? And the kids who are going abroad are the kids who are driven by conviction, thinking they're doing the right thing because they're following in the footsteps of Muhammad.
Mm. Overnight, our own Foreign Minister Julie Bishop argued that Islamic State is the worst ideology the world has seen since Nazism. Do you see similarities with National Socialism in this sort of central appeal to the return to the tribe, in the example of Nazism, the Aryan tribe, an invitation to sort of lose yourself in the great sea of us inside a movement that's powerful, that's on the move, and that wants to swallow up the whole world?
And the parallels with National Socialism, the parallels with communism, the parallels with any other kind of totalitarianism is this ability to divide the world into us and them, those who believe and those who disbelieve. Even if you're a Muslim, it's not enough to be a Muslim. You know, you have to believe in a certain way. You have to be puritanical. And those who do not believe, they must be made to submit or they must be destroyed. And once the destruction has taken place, out of the destruction, something pure and great will come. And there you see the activities of the Islamic State. And what we have failed, in the liberal world is when we do, you know, we have actually lived in the West through both of these totalitarianisms and Marxists promised paradise and they gave us the gulag. National Socialism promised some form of utopia and paradise and they gave us the Holocaust. And now it is apparently time for the Medina Muslims' promise that through jihad something wonderful is going to happen and we have the Islamic State. And we need to be able to take these lessons and disseminate them to the Muslim audiences, particularly the young and impressionable, and show them why what's being promised during da'wah, during those years and days of preaching, is not going to lead to what they think it will lead.
Mm. But that goes to the point of what radicalizes these young men. Is it the lure of political ideology or something much more universal and base. There's a wonderful quote in your book, I'll quote you to yourself. For young people who have limited chances to achieve fame and notoriety, jihad is like one giant selfie. And that rings true here in Australia. There seems to be a strong narcissistic bent in the would-be jihadist. We've seen a man here in Australia recently, Tariq Kamle, a narcissistic doctor. When he lived in Australia, he was this sort of hard-drinking, frantic fornicator whose infidelity to his girlfriend was in equal parts sort of crude and comic. And he suddenly emerges as this holy warrior in surgical scrubs. Narcissism.
It is narcissism, and narcissism is a universal trait. Narcissism affects all people to some degree, and people from all over, you know, the world, different cultures and everything. But then there is Islam, and there is Medina Islam, or Islam as it was practiced. Let me put it this way. The Prophet Muhammad's narcissism. The Prophet Muhammad did many things that appealed to narcissists, and he left a legacy behind that make them feel all powerful. If he did it, I can do it too. It justifies and it makes righteous and feel people feel as if they're doing the right thing when they follow in these footsteps. How on earth could you ever justify a beheading in public? How could you justify burning someone alive? How could you justify taking women into slavery? The only way you could do it is by saying the Prophet Muhammad did it and it must be right.
I wonder whether you're giving the teenager, you know, the Aussie teenager who's a would-be jihadist a little bit too much credit. Does he really rationalise it like this, or is it the appeal of guns and selfies?
I was a teenager once upon a time, and I was radicalised, and during my radicalisation process, and it wasn't only mine, if we had been told, oh, come and, you know, burst into your very own narcissism, I don't think that would have been at all appealing. And by the way, there were other ways of expressing narcissism at that time and even now. But what made it exceptional was the fact that you're pleasing Allah, you're doing it for the sake of Allah. Life on earth here is temporary. You're commanding Christ and forbidding wrong. There is a purpose. You're transcending yourself. You're part of a universal community and all of that. And if that has to be acknowledged, if we shy away from acknowledging the theological part of this, which is the main part, then I think we'll just be talking in circles as we've been doing for the last 3 or 4 decades.
So what does this reformation look like? Is it as stark as a denial of central elements and tenets of Islam?
I think what this reformation looks like is when I was sitting behind my desk and thinking, is it possible to separate religion from politics in Islam? And if so, what would we need to remove from Islam to make it into a religion? And I pinpoint these 5 key aspects: the attitude toward Muhammad and the Quran, especially in Medina, this overinvestment in life after death, Sharia law, commanding Christ and forbidding Kong, and jihad. If you take these things out of Islam, and it's widely recognized this is unacceptable, then you're going to be left with Islam purely as a religion as we define it in the West, at least, and as it is protected in the constitutions of Western society. And that opens a place, you know, it opens a debate, or it opens an opportunity for Muslims to be Muslim and not have to deal with politics through the window of religion. They can just deal with politics as everyone else does.
Forgive me, but it sounds like a prescription put forward by an atheist, which I think you are.
And that's why I called the book a heretic, because every single time in the history of Islam, when Muslims from within have put prescriptions for change, they've been described as heretics, infidels, traitors, and so on. And so I think if change is to come, it is going to come from the heretics. It's not going to come from the grand muftis or from the clergymen. It's not going to come from the autocratic despots. It's going to come from the heretics. I'm talking about true enduring change. True enduring change, not a pretense of change.
I wonder how that happens. I mean, crucial to the Christian Reformation was Gutenberg's printing press, you know, access to universities. And some would say...
The internet.
The internet, exactly my point, has displaced this Enlightenment notion of scholarship. You know, my ignorant opinion is just as important as your expert scholarship. You're just an elite, or a professor of climate change is just an elite. How do you affect a reformation in that environment?
Well, first of all, Islam, as opposed to Christianity, doesn't have a church hierarchy. And when you look at these self-appointed men who have a fellowship and who are recruiting masses and masses of Muslims, men and women, young and old, to join the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, you name it, all of these different brands, then you realize that the internet can also be used to mobilize a group for reform. And that's what the Muslim reformers are doing. So the internet can be used either for a good purpose, or it can be used for a bad purpose. And I think that we've neglected to support those who indeed want to use it for a good purpose, the purpose of reform.
I mean, arguably, though, fundamental to the internet is that there is no one opinion is more important than any one opinion, and regardless of how many competing opinions you get out there, unless you can say, as Martin Luther did, this is the truth, this is the way, I am the leadership and I will affect this outcome, don't you have a fundamental problem with what you're prescribing?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm appealing to the reason of individual Muslims along with the other reformers. And those who agree, they don't have to agree with every aspect of it, but those who agree at least with the minimum moralia of, yes, the Prophet Muhammad and the Quran can be questioned instead of followed blindly, that is, I would say, a fantastic beginning, and that process has begun. And just to demonstrate, in Saudi Arabia, there's a man who has no idea who I am, who's never heard of me, who started a blog, and his blog was, he was just simply questioning Saudi society, the concentration of power in the hands of the clergymen, the treatment of women, you know, and he is sentenced to 1,000 lashes, 1,000 lashes to be administered, 50 at the time, a million riyal and 10 years in prison. And who did that? Of course, the clergymen. That is the kind of contest we are talking about and context. And it's up to you and, you know, the liberal community to decide who they want to side with, the Saudi government or Raif Badawi.
Is it, let me put this to you. Some listening will say there's a risk in this critique. There's a danger in this critique because you don't say the problem is a perversion of Islam. You say the problem is Islam and that that in itself ferments intolerance and may in itself drive young people into extremism.
That is pertinently untrue. It is a fallacy that has been keeping us fastened to the desires of the Honor Brigade. I think that it is extremely important to say that, yes, it is Islam, unreformed, and there is a diversity in Muslims, and there are those who want to reform, there are those who are, you know, caught in a state of dissonance, and there are those, the Medina Muslims, who are marching us into darkness. And in order to get out of it, we have to, of course, recognize that it is Islam in itself. And before it is reformed, as all other religions have gone through a reformation and an enlightenment process, and so must Islam. And I think it is the grim reality, and it's demonstrated every single day on the front pages of newspapers and the television and on the internet. And in human life, you know, just imagine if you are a young woman or a young man and your village is attacked by Boko Haram, or you're occupied by the Islamic State, or you live in Pakistan and your school is attacked by the Taliban. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. This is in real life. You live in Yemen and you have a proxy war between Sunni Saudi Arabia and Iran Shia attacking you, and you have millions of people displaced today from Iran, from Syria, from Lebanon. That is, I don't want us to talk about the people who are, you know, claiming that they're suffering Islamophobia. I want us to talk about the boatfuls of people who are running away from their homes because of the jihadists and because of what is happening to them in the name of Medina Muslims. They are the true victims.
A fascinating discussion. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today, Ayan.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
Author and activist Ayan Hirsi Ali and her new book, Heretic, Why Islam Needs a Reformation Now, is published by HarperCollins.